Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, movie troopers. Welcome to this week's episode of Troop and Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm Campbell A. Gamble.
And I'm Mike McCagle.
On the show this week, Hamaguchi returns with Evil Does Not Exist. Dev Patel makes his directorial debut in Monkey Man, and Hannah Strong spoke to the man himself. And on Film Club, it's Dev's choice of A Bittersweet Life. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, welcome, welcome. Mike, I think this is your first time you've been on an episode with me, so delights await you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's the first time since, I think, 2019, when I was in the more than capable hands of Michael Leader, and I believe your predecessor in this chair. So it's good to be back. Lots happened, a lot of water under the bridge. But I've mostly been the same old recluse, just sort of staying at home. I'm trying to be J.D. Salinger, but this business insists that I be J.D. Sports. So here I am.
Oh, I'm sure you are being very humble. You are. What have you been up to of late? Any kind of exciting work or projects?
So I'm doing a few things for the upcoming UK Asian Film Festival, which is going on in May. So I'm Q&A-ing the closing night gala film, which is Lord Curzon Kaihavali, and it's on at the lovely Regent Street Cinema. And you can get, I believe there are still tickets available. You can go to tonguesonfire.com. And you can find out a few more details there.
Yeah, very nice.
See me in the flesh. Shout things at me. Throw things at me. Do what you will with me.
Campbell A. Campbell, the man so great they named him twice. How are you doing? What are you up to?
That's actually a fairly new variation on a theme. I'm good. I've been having the rare quiet one for freelancers, which is actually like a mostly voluntary one, you know, where, like, we've talked about it before, where you kind of go through these peaks and valleys of panic and other panic, but the peaks and valleys are I have work, no work, and I have too much work. So I'm currently comfortably in the sort of dip at the moment. So I've just been doing like little bits and pieces, reviewing animation as usual, and less capable live action adaptations. I watched Avatar for a commission. It wasn't very good. Yeah, I've mostly just been cleaning up, like, anime runs in seasons, and I review a lot of that. So the most recent one has sort of just closed, so a lot of shows have wrapped up, and now I'm preparing for the next one. Annecy, a big festival for me, is just over around the corner, so I'll be prepping to go and cover that, and seeing a bunch of new things that are in progress and things that are for imminent release. For example, like, Robot Dreams played at Annecy last year. So I'm sort of planning ahead for planning ahead. Much like Mike, I'm sort of doing that all in hermit mode.
Don't use me as a mentor or anything representative. This is a bad way to live your career. You're a young man. You've got your life ahead of you. Don't do this. Don't follow me into the void.
It's too late. You showed me how.
But got to give you a little thank you also, Cam, because, you're also kind of delving into some philanthropy with me. You've donated a really cool lot to Cinema for Gaza, which is, I think at time of recording, will have gone live. So thanks very much.
Oh, no problem. It's funny because it's a very me-coded item. It's beautiful art book for Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, which has this like big textured slipcover. It's all very luxurious. It's got these little character designer inserts, which are really beautiful as well. It was one of those ones where I was looking at it and I was just like, damn, I really want to keep this. And so I knew that would be meant it would be a good item. It's kind of my birthday present policy as well. It's like, if I really want it, it's got to go.
Oh, well, very much appreciated. You're in good company. We got some new Jonathan Glazer stuff coming up, and Melissa Barrera's coming on board, Peter Strickland. It's just cracked 60K on day three. So
wow, that's unbelievable.
That's terrific.
That is my source of dopamine at the moment. Aside
we
from
all
the
need one.
Yeah, so alongside my peers, Jonathan Glazer and...
Well, you know, you'd be surprised, actually. I mean, some of the lots that you would not necessarily think would be like giant earners are doing like incredibly well. So for all we know, you and Glazer might be neck and neck with your lots within
few hours. I expect it will happen. some of those are so cool. I saw Annie Lennox posting about her lyrics earlier.
Yeah, no, she's a real one, is Miss Lennox. Andrea Riseborough coming on today as well. So yeah, I mean, it's a very, very talented group of people, which is actually really nice too. We're not at all having to compromise on taste, because all of the donors are like incredible artists and creatives.
Generous and talented.
It sounds like, you know, we're talking about how reclusive we all are, but I think, you know, occasionally, every now and again, something brings us all together. This is my we are the world speech. But, you know, as an industry, every now and again, I think we're all looking for excuses to get involved and do stuff. And this does seem to be a very good reason to get involved.
I think it makes for a nice counter-narrative to the idea that support for Palestine is unpopular. It's nice to see people kind of come and show love for their, like, instead of sort of just fearing that it's a blight on their careers or whatever. It's affirming in its own kind of sad way.
Yeah, there was something, we've got a great lot from Frankie Boyle, and he said something the other day that really like stayed with me, where he's like, I'm just very disappointed in anyone that isn't kind of saying something at this point, because if you'd lose work, it's not work that you'd want to be doing anyhow.
It's be poisoned.
Anyway, I mean, on that incredibly dark note, should move on to, I'd love, the cheerily titled Evil Does Not Exist.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member, who receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Deep in the forest of the small rural village Harasawa, single parent Takumi lives with his young daughter Hannah and takes care of the odd jobs for locals, chopping wood and hauling pristine well water. The overpowering serenity of this untouched land of mountains and lakes, where deer peacefully roam free, is about to be disrupted by the imminent arrival of a Tokyo company, Playmode, which is starting to get ready to construct a glamping site for city tourists. So, Cam, this is an incredible film. I absolutely adored this. I saw it first in October, but it's really stayed with me. I mean, how was your first impression of watching this?
I'm a latecomer to Hamaguchi. I jumped on with a lot of other people during the doubleheader of Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy and Drive My Car, both of which I loved. It's quite funny seeing people kind of take sides on which one was better. I'm Team Drive My Car.
I'm Team Drive My Car too, yeah. Mike?
I think I'm, just for balance, I'm Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy. But I do like Drive My Car as well, so it's fine.
I love it. But Evil Doesn't Exist was a very different one from both of those, like more oblique. As ever, Mark Ash had my favourite words on his sort of style in that I think he called it something like Uniqlo Core. like Uniqlo Core, like soap opera in terms of what he's doing in Drive My Car and Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, but it's because both are so understated, but are dealing with these very dramatic turns in their characters' lives. Evil Does Not Exist is sort of at this more abstract, decompressed, just generally ominous pace that felt strikingly different from both of those. And I suppose that's a part of why it stuck with me as well, because it's so opaque, not necessarily in what it's trying to communicate, but in terms of the sort of, if you view the ending literally, you're going to have a strange time with this, is what I'm trying to say. And I didn't expect that's kind of abstraction from Hamaguchi, and it was very exciting to see because I was like, oh, he can work in almost an entirely different mode than what made him not a household name, but significantly more popular in the past couple of years. And that he can just put out so many bangers at such a quick pace is also very exciting. I need to go back and watch his earlier films like Happy Hour, that sort of thing.
Mike, what about for you? I mean, coming into this as a Hamaguchi fan, did this kind of meet your expectations?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's clearly a sort of novelistic filmmaker, and you know, Happy Hour was his epic novel. Drive My Car is his sort of breakthrough book. You know, the book that gets onto the shelves at both Waterstones and Tesco and sells a lot of copies. And Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy is like a short story collection. This is more like experimental fiction for me. And the big risk that it takes is that it delays the what would traditionally be the inciting incident at the start of Act Two. It pushes it way back into Act Three. So for a long time, you're getting, as Cam says, this sort of very slow, steady accretion of detail about a community and the threat facing it. And it starts, you start thinking about things you don't entirely expect to be thinking about. So I spent most of this film thinking more than I usually would about the environmental implications of glamping. I don't think I've ever thought about glamping so much, or even the word glamping, which is a horrible word, and even just hearing it come out of my mouth fills me with great shame. There's a whole sort of subplot about the precise positioning of a septic tank. So you're setting up this sense of a place and the people who live there. It's a little bit like watching footprints appear in the snow, and you're going on a fairly straight track for the most part, but then towards the end it suddenly veers off. And I think people will be thrown by that, but I also think that enough stuff is set up in the first two-thirds of this movie for you to start piecing it together and to actually have it. You will, guaranteed, whether you like this film or not, you will have a big conversation at the end of it with the people you've gone to see it with. It is a film that invites interpretation. But I think he would not have won the Oscar for this, which is not to say that it's a bad film. It's just that this is far less reassuring than I think Drive My Car was, which had all the stuff about art and creation and the stuff that the Academy voters could respond to. This is much more risky, I think, as a proposition.
I mean, for you, Cam, like you talked about taking the ending literally. I mean, is that something that you've found yourself having conversations about, as Mike insists that we all will?
It's not really the, it's not the same as the sort of, actually, no, Anatomy of a Fall is a bad example as well, because I feel like the did she do it thing wasn't really the point of the film. But I kind of feel like you could have a similar conversation about this, as to, like, you could talk for days about like the kind of psychology of the actual act of what happens, but I think it is connected to this larger point, as Mike said, about the area that we've come to know because of that accumulation of detail. Like you said, it's sort of like this, like the moment towards the end is this sort of expulsion of this sort of horrible vibe that the film has from its very beginning. It's, I think I said this already, but it's so much more ominous than his other two films, in part, I think, because of the sort of tone of the soundtrack. I feel like it's sort of just like one octave lower than the scores from his previous films. And it just something feels just like immediately off key, so to speak. And it sort of builds this strange underlying tension or the sense that something is going to go wrong. And then, like you said, it delays that moment for such a long time that it just becomes part of the area, like a sickness. And it's funny that that sickness is presented with this very like kitschy, like glamping presentation suffered by these poor middle managers. And that's where I think in the accumulation of the evil, the titular evil, I think it's the film is at its funniest that it's so banal, and that it has an interest in the forces on the other side of this sort of competition between the locals and big business moving in and occupying well, not occupying land, I think it's different. It's more like, I don't know, just bespoiling the land, I guess. But it's just quite funny that it's everyone is the victim of these higher forces, and that these middle managers kind of just have to deal with this terrible job just as, in the same way that all of the people in town don't want it either. It's just all so poorly managed and, for lack of a better word, a shit show. And it's just quite funny to see. I mean, it's surprisingly funny. All this rambling is me trying to say that I think Hamaguchi is kind of continuing to show that he's a very humanist filmmaker, in that he can consider the people behind these kind of two very large concepts. Like, he localizes it all with these like personalities and what's going on with their lives. It's not just it's not all high concept, big ideas that kind of leave you sort of aghast like the ending does. It's not designed to shock in that way. I'm trying not to like overstate that part, but it's a very interesting continuation of his sort of thematic interests, but also, like Mike said, like in this way that isn't so... Drive My Car isn't populist, but it's less populist than that, I suppose.
We should also talk about, you know, it's not just about the writing. It is about the way he frames this story. I think he has this preference for very clean, crisp, uncluttered frames that both open up a window onto contemporary Japan, so we know exactly where we are, whether we're in the city in his earlier films or in the countryside as we are here. But also in this case, those clean, crisp, uncluttered frames seem to invite some kind of development or despoilment. So you're looking at this waiting for something terrible to happen, but he's also open to other elements. So yeah, as Kem says, you know, the middle managers are, in an American movie, they'd be sort of cigar chomping capitalists of the most vulgar kind, but here they're actually quite nice, quite deferential. They listen to the concerns the locals have. And for a while, I thought it was going to go down that local hero route where some kind of osmosis happens and they get, you know, absorbed into the community and they go back to their boss and say, we don't want to, you know, snatch this land away from the community. But this is not that film. So I think a lot of it is about things being snatched away. It's about the idea of the commons, you know, that shared space in the middle of medieval communities that people had as a resource and they could go there and they could plant things. And that's how that's been snatched away from us. But even like the soundtrack, I mean, I love the score by Eiko Ishibashi, which is sort of very lilting and sort of piano and strings. And just as you're getting used to that and relaxing into that, he'll snatch it away with a cut. So it's about things being snatched away, I think. I think that sort of sets up something that will happen later on in the film. But yeah, it is much more of a risky proposition than the stuff that's come forward. And I think people will be thrown, but I think the storytelling is so strong that, you know, you won't be alienated from it completely.
I do like how the decompression kind of first comes into the film. It's all very kind of, I guess that you have that sort of, like you said, that not really a cluttered frame, but there's the shot that's looking upwards at the trees that sort of just drifts along for, I think it's something like a solid like minute of just following the tree line from the ground up. And then after that, it's the groundskeeper just chopping wood for for a long time, and
it's very relaxing. It's very relaxing, yeah. Up until the point it gets unnerving. That's the issue.
Yeah, everything just lingers for a beat too long.
Yeah, and he's not like a sort of radical filmmaker. Anyway, I think a lot about this film is quite small C conservative. You know, it's about preservation. It's about, you know, hanging on to whatever resources we've got. And I think formally, it's not sort of particularly radical, the way that it's framed. But he's almost a filmmaker who's come along at exactly the right time, because he's sort of restored this idea of cause and effect in storytelling. It's almost like what's going on in the film is a metaphor for storytelling within movies as a whole. The way storytelling has kind of been corrupted and poisoned by this new corporate form of storytelling where stories only exist to set up other stories in other universes. He is much more of a traditionalist in that respect. And there's a kind of responsibility within these stories that I don't see elsewhere in cinema. So it's like, I don't think he's doing anything particularly new, but he's just reminding us that of what a well-told story looks like.
It's quite funny how grand those ideas sound and then how unassuming the film is by comparison. Yeah, just very subdued like the whole way.
Yeah, and it is kind of sort of shrugging, but I guess that's the sign of a master storyteller, that, you know, you can put this out without making it seem like there's any great effort or, you know, huffing and puffing going on behind it.
Even like with a very strong environmentalist message, it's hardly like didactic. And like you said, you can infer so much from it without feeling like it's preaching at you, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, we should get some scores on this. Camille, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I think I'm straight fours on this one. I didn't expect him to release a film so soon after Drive My Car, and not just Drive My Car, but the doubleheader of that and Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy. But when I heard there was a new Hamaguchi, I was excited for it, so there was that. I'm keeping enjoyment out of four because it's not like, you know, it's not like a roller coaster or anything. It somehow has even less drama than something like Drive My Car, but even with its sort of decompression and kind of off-putting, intentionally off-putting atmosphere, I found it quite funny in its approach to the middle managers. It's still, like, we've talked about how it has these grand ideas about environmentalism and storytelling and, like, the preservation of communities, but it is also very, it's very interested in how silly people can be and, like, the little mistakes that kind of build up in this capitalist machine. So I think there is that kind of just ground level charm to it. And in retrospect, yeah, 4. I think I need to watch more Hamaguchi work before I'm just like, yeah, this is top of his game 5. Like, so I'm tentatively keeping it around there because I think, yeah, Drive My Car was a 5 for me.
Mike, what about you?
I think anticipation 4, because it's like having a favourite novelist putting a new work in the world off the back of a couple of big international bestsellers. Enjoyment, I would drop down to a 3, because I think for me it was more like, as we hopefully defined here, it's more like terse engagement than enjoyment. You know, you are sitting on the edge of the seat wondering where this is heading. And in retrospect, I'd go 4, because, oh, you know, it went there. It does go somewhere. It does take you there. And I think we're at this sort of blessed stage in Hamaguchi's career where he is revealing himself to us film by film and showing us all the very many things he can do. And he hasn't repeated himself yet.
Yeah, no, I think I'm with you around the 4-4-4. I mean, it just feels like such a wonderful thing when a filmmaker that you adore, you know, is also kind of churning out things at a rate of knots. I mean, I always think people that love Stephen King must just be so happy all the time.
it's a constant stream of content.
Oh, yes, Hamaguchi content.
I know, I like that way of kind of acting like Drive My Car is basically like a comic book movie or something.
When's the sequel? When are we getting the Murakami Cinematic Universe?
But we should move on to our next film. It's Monkey Man. Kid sets on a journey to hunt down a group of corrupt leaders who are responsible for his mother Neela's death. However, Kid's journey of exacting revenge soon makes him become the saviour of the poor and powerless. Before we get into the film, here's Hannah Strong with Dev Patel.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I mean, for you, this must have been an incredible journey, considering I spoke to you in 2019 for David Copperfield, and I remember you were talking about the film then, how excited you were. So obviously, you know, it's been a long time in the works, so I know you're not without difficulty.
Yes.
For you, what has that journey been like? And could you maybe tell me about this, where the kind of spark came from that started all of this?
Oh, the spark was a few things. I guess I'm just a huge fan of the action genre, you know, ever since I, you know, snuck downstairs and watched Bruce Lee in Enter the Dragon. I became obsessed with that and took up martial arts and bought myself some, you know, rubber nunchucks and broke every cabinet in the house possible. But that kind of birthed my love of cinema, actually. That was the gateway drug to watching movies. And then it was, you know, Jet Li, Jackie Chan, Sammo, Donnie Yen, you know, all of those guys. And then I got introduced to Korean cinema, and that really just took it to a whole new level. And then, you know, my grandfather used to, my dad has this chain around his neck with this Hanuman kind of little symbol. And I used to ask my dad, like, what's that about? And he goes, wait till your grandfather comes down. He'll tell you the story better than me. And my grandfather was this incredible. He is this incredible storyteller. And I used to make him sit in my box room and he would tell me these stories. And the character I loved the most was obviously Hanuman. And you know, I was like, if I was ever going to make a movie, I would make one about him. But I couldn't figure out how to not make the $200 million Lord of the Rings like fantasy epic at the time until it clicked, this kind of performing monkey in a ring, you know, being beaten up and kind of like, you know, has this kind of masochistic streak to him. That was the kind of like the first kind of whiff of an idea.
I mean, I think the character of the kid is very interesting because we're so used to seeing in action movies leads who are like perfect from the get-go. Yeah. You know, like you watch John Wick, you watch even like Die Hard, it's like, oh, this guy is just really, really good at everything straight away.
Safe pair
of hands. There is this kind of element of danger in the film where you're like, this guy could die at any moment. Mm. Like, he's very reckless and doesn't always, you know, especially in the ring, it's like, like you say, it's a total kind of masochistic streak. It's not like about how well he's fighting. It's just go in there and kind of feel something.
Yeah, I think truly to create an underdog, you know, you need a formidable villain, but you also need him to be flawed. That's a huge part of the hero's journey. And I think, you know, I think a big part of revenge is that everyone feels you can't be in check of your emotions. Like if you were feeling such crippling rage inside you, I wouldn't know how you'd keep a handle on those feelings, let alone execute on a moment you've been waiting for your whole life perfectly. You wouldn't be able to do it, you know, like the movies do it. So things would go wrong. He would be out of his element, and that creates a great arc of growth.
Rather than having like the final confrontation, you have that kind of build up of him having the kind of, okay, this is my moment, final confrontation, and then it's like,
he gets
that
absolutely mauled and ragdolled. But it also creates a great opportunity for the kind of like the visual language of the action from being cuttier and more chaotic to, you know, when he becomes more composed, it's more steely in this kind of like violent ballet by the end of it.
Yeah, it goes more John Wick, as they kind of say in the film.
Yeah.
That leads me on to a kind of very important question, which is working with like a stunt team and a fight team as not only an actor but as a director this time, how did you kind of communicate? Do you want to talk a little about those guys and how you guys were able to realize the vision?
I mean, it was everything that I had planned had kind of fallen apart because of the pandemic and for various other reasons. You know, once we landed in Indonesia without the John Wick stunt team that we thought we were going to have, I was kind of lost, and then I got sent some YouTube videos and found this guy, Brahim Chab. And Brahim, you know, I called him on the phone and I said, you know, this is kind of what I'm looking for. I think you're fantastic and I need you here yesterday. So he came in, and, you know, the idea was just to create some kind of an action that was, you know, born from real desperation. And fight against the choreographic nature of what action scenes can be sometimes, you know, so make it jagged, make it raw and surprising. And I was, again, my own worst enemy because they chop it up in the previses and I'm like, no, we can hire Steven, this guy who's I saw in the stunt room. He was, you know, one of the camera operators that was shooting the little previses on a cheap camera. And I took him aside and we had a chat and he's like, I've always wanted to be a DP and operate. And I was like, well, here's your chance. And so we literally had I call him the ninja, but he was kind of in under the armpit of the action.
Leaving
it. Yeah. And it was allowed us to do some really interesting things with it.
I mean, I think a lot of like big films, when you see really good second unit, it's because like they've got someone who knows how to shoot action scenes.
Yeah.
I think it's so kind of underappreciated as a skill because it, you know, so much now in modern blockbusters you're like, oh man, this just looks
and they rely so much on second unit. I mean, we didn't have a second unit because I'm in every frame, so it was just first unit. But yeah,
you shot obviously in Indonesia because of pandemic, because of production constraints, but the film is set in Mumbai, which is where Slumdog Millionaire was set and where Lion was set and where Hotel Mumbai was set. So it's obviously somewhere that your career has been very tied to. How did it feel for you to be able to kind of go back knowing that you were in control of the kind of the story at that time?
I mean, we were originally going to shoot in Mumbai, then the pandemic hit, so we shot it in Indonesia. But it's set in a kind of fictional Indian metropolis called Yatana, which derives from the Sanskrit word meaning purgatory. But for me, it's like, you know, I wanted to just be represented in the genre, and I just, you know, instead of being the funny sidekick or the guy hacking the mainframe for the lead guy, it's like, you know, I know we've got a lot to offer. And the only other reference point for anyone that will come up to me is like, oh, they've seen that Bollywood action movie or that, and they do it incredibly well. But, you know, for someone that's grown up on a diet of the films I've mentioned, there was nothing else. And for me, I'm a product of two different worlds, and I wanted that represented in cinema. Like, what does a future look like for people like me? So yeah, that's where that came in.
That's really interesting, because I was thinking about this, and you know, the film isn't quite like a, you know, a big Bollywood film, which are incredible feats of like production, stunt coordination, but it's not quite that. It's not quite a, you know, a big Hollywood thing. It does feel kind of like something new. And I guess I'm curious, like, you know, you've been acting a very long time now. Was this genuinely something that you kind of felt was, you weren't even kind of seeing getting made?
Yeah, I mean, everyone looks for comps when you're trying to make a movie. So they're like, what is it? And you have to, like, you know, it's
what's it similar to?
It's John Wick meets this, meets that. And, you know, for industry that's, you know, prides itself on being original and creative, it can be terribly uncreative, the real decision makers and the people spending the money. So, you know, for me in my head, I knew the feeling I wanted to capture. And there was moments that I knew I was going to tip my hat to some iconic kind of staples of the genre, the training montage, for instance. Or I was going to do my own little car, poor man's car chase, but on a three-wheeler. Or, you know, I was going to do, you know, the guy escaping from a building, but not through a window. You know, like, you know, just do my own spin on stuff. So, yeah.
Speaking of, you know, you kind of mentioned a few titles. We're doing a film club for Monkey Man, and I would very much like you to give us that title. Just a film that kind of you had in your head that isn't John Wick, because that would be very obvious. Maybe one that did inspire a specific moment in the film.
Wow.
So I'm putting you on the spot now. But
what, one film or how many films?
Just one.
Just one film to watch. I would say watch. I'm not going to say Old Boy, because that is everyone's probably seen that. So I'll probably go with a film called Man... No, A Bittersweet Life.
Oh, okay. I'm not familiar.
Yeah, Lee Byung-hun.
Okay, fantastic. I mean, I remember last time I spoke to you, you mentioned how much you love Korean cinema.
Yeah.
And we were talking at the time about you meeting Bong Joon-ho.
Yeah.
And accosting him.
Yeah.
So I guess that's like another influence on the film, like the kind of Korean dramas.
Hugely.
And Korean action movies.
Yeah, hugely. I think the way they deal with vengeance in this, they're so pulpy and violent, and they don't hide away from that, or the pathos and the emotion of it, and so for me that's, yeah, it's a huge inspiration.
It's kind of interesting to see a film where I feel like now when we watch revenge films there's a lot of like, but actually, you know, the revenge isn't necessary, you know, he's got personal catharsis, and it's like no, I think he's quite justified in what he's doing.
Yeah, and not giving too much away, but you know, what happens to him because of revenge is interesting too. Yeah,
and I mean, I guess like in the kind of fables and in the kind of allegories that we hear, a lot of them do end with these kind of big moments of like, you know, not to reveal what happens to the listeners, but these big kind of showdowns or set pieces. Mm-hmm. So was it important for you to kind of mimic this like structure that you had within the stories that inspired it?
Yeah, it kind of the chips fell that way. But yeah, there was moments where I was like, you know, I did want the, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but yeah, there is some, you know, it makes you wait. It demands your patience at times. There's a lot of world building, character building. And then when I wanted to make sure when we do touch the action, we go for it.
Mm. I guess very briefly to touch on kind of how the film finally got out into the world. I know that Jordan Peele has been such a massive part of that. How has it been for you kind of working with him as a kind of partner, I guess, to shepherd the film out finally?
Yeah, I mean, I was getting ready to kind of say goodbye to this dream, and I was writing this long text to all the people that had worked on this, kind of apologizing for letting them down, and it was a very hard place to be in, and basically stepped off the film at that point. And then, you know, I get a call, and my agent's like, you know, Jordan Peele wants to talk to you, and he'd seen the film 3 times, and he was obsessed with it. And it was like, you know, I couldn't believe I was talking to this incredible auteur, you know, this cinematic juggernaut who...
One of the best.
Yeah, and he just was like, you know, I hope you don't mind, I've shared it with Universal and we want to buy it. And I nearly fell off my chair. You know, we had this little... It had been a marathon up until then, and then we had the final sprint with Jordan and his team, and they allowed us to, you know, brush up on some VFX that we couldn't do and stuff like that, and put some finishing touches on it, which was amazing.
It's so lovely the way that he does seem to be very much involved in kind of shepherding, you know, kind of other talent. He's not like, I'm in the door, that's it. He's like, kind of, no, like everyone, lovely to see. I think I find him so, not only an incredible filmmaker, but just the stuff he's doing in Monkey Paw, bringing other people up. I love him.
He's a beast.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So, Mike, this is Jordan Peele produced. Apparently, there was a good chance that it was never going to see the light of day, but he kind of rescued it from oblivion. I mean, do you think that was a worthwhile pursuit?
Oh, yes. Big yes on that front. I remember bumping into Deb Patel in 2010 in the immediate wake of Slumdog Millionaire, and he was at the London Critics Circle Awards, and my plus one for the evening had just interviewed him. So she went over to say hello, and he was very nice and very sweet and very lovely. He also looked like a rabbit in the headlights. And I think that was the defining image of Deb Patel in his early films. I mean, he looked scared of me, and I was, you know, in 2010, I was a 10-stone weakling. So in the last year, something has really clicked with Deb Patel. I think, you know, my age and experience and studying his art and craft has kind of really propelled him forward. This is a film made with immense confidence. It's not just the way he occupies the screen. You know, he is properly kicking ass here in an interesting way, but it's also the way the film is written and directed. If we were handing out a Rosette for most improved in cinema, I think Deb Patel would win it, you know, at a canter at this point.
Yeah, I mean, you think back to Skins, he would never kind of struck me as the one
leading man, you know. He was a skinny little weakling, and you know, actually in this he's still quite skinny and he's quite upright. And one of the sort of visually striking things about it is that he hasn't necessarily bulked up for this role, because the character does not have access to whey powder and, you know, gym time. So, you know, he's a bit like a sort of toothbrush in the frame, but he fights like a wounded animal, and that there's something to say. And, you know, it is a work of complete confidence. 45 minutes in, I sat there going, there hasn't been a single uninteresting image in this film. There's no way that he can keep this up. You know, this is a directorial debut. He'll flag eventually. And then an hour and 20 minutes later, the credits rolled, the lights came up, and I sat there going, you know what, he's done it. He's pulled this off. This is a film without a single uninteresting image. You know, why can't all Saturday night popcorn movies look as good as this, move as fast as this, and be as rich and as weird as this?
Oh, Campbell, same for you. Did you kind of find it wonderfully weird?
Yeah, for better and for worse, I think it was taking some very broad swings and hit most of them. I agree with what you said about the kind of transformation of Dev Patel's cinematic image, where he's gone from that very meek character on skins to, as you said, a wounded animal whose frame is kind of emulating that of Bruce Lee's. I said in my written review for Little White Lies that that was also a striking thing to me, that he's just like very lithe and athletic in the same way that those Hong Kong action stars are, and that he's using kind of like the whole length of his frame to kick people as well as throw improvised weapons at them. In terms of like the confidence of this film, it does feel like a movie that was saved from potentially never coming out, because so much of the stuff, there's so many ideas in here, it feels like it's the last movie he's ever going to make, or at least maybe he thought that when he was making it. So he's just like, that's probably part of why the pace feels so quick, why there are so many interesting ideas in it, and why it feels a little bit overwhelmed, because there are just so many things that he wants to do. There are so many different films that he wants to homage. There are so many things about his heritage that he wants to address. I mean, the film opens with a reading from the Ramayana. I don't know enough about that. I'll probably defer to Mike on any of the homages to Bollywood and Indian culture, but he's also been on this press tour basically just being like, yeah, I love Sammo Hung. I love Korean action cinema. I wanted to make a film that was a little bit like The Raid. And you can kind of see all of those bits coalescing. A little bit of The Raid in how the film is shot in this very frantic handheld style, and also just its sheer brutality. There's a bit of Sammo Hung in the comedy, as well as in some of the improvisation that I mentioned before. There's a bit where his character like tries to kind of dramatically jump out a window and he just bounces straight off it, which is very funny that he, even in these very serious narrative circumstances, he is willing to have his character have the shit kicked out of him for a laugh. There's definitely a lot of Korean cinema in this sort of black-suited figure rebelling against a big organization, stabbing a lot of guys while he's at it. And seeing all of these different influences like coalesce into something like Monkey Man is very exciting, even if it feels very busy. And I think there are a lot of digressions in the middle that sort of confused me. Maybe it's a skill issue in reading a film, but there are some elements that I've lost track of while I was trying to keep pace with it, I guess. It felt like stream of consciousness almost, and I said this already in my written, but in a way that is both kind of exciting to see a film that feels like it's sprung directly from somebody's brain, but then also probably like my own rambling, it can be a bit hard to follow. So definitely very exciting. I hope he gets to make another film like this, because I want to see all of those influences kind of like, they could take him in any direction, because there are so many different things that he's studied and seems to love.
He's directing like a wounded animal. He's grabbing whatever's to hand, and you know, in the same way that the character, you know, grabs a frying pan or a kettle and smashes someone over the head with it. You know, as a director, he's clearly spent the last 10 years watching a lot of movies and pouring it into this one vessel. So it does need a bit of unpacking. I agree. I quite like that, you know, the richness of it. But I think also the action movies are incredibly clear and coherent in the lines that they go down. I think, you know, I was always aware of where the characters were in the frame and what the goal was for that particular fight. Yeah, I think it also has that sort of incredible density of images that we're getting now in 21st century cinema. So it's a mixture of craft and things that he's learned from elsewhere, but also keeping a close eye on the things that matter when he is taking those big swings in the action sequences.
I mean, he's using a lot of like point of view insert shots as well. And there's like a lot of the fights are just shot from an incredibly low angle. It just feels very overwhelming. I mean, it's designed to feel overwhelming. And like you said, it kind of contributes to that sort of cornered animal kind of feeling. And I'm just thinking about the fight scene at the beginning with like Charlton Copley as the skeezy ring announcer. And I'm just, that man has settled into this very strange kind of typecasting where it's just like, you need a scumbag.
Call Charlton. Better call Charlton.
I gotta say, I did have quite a bit of a strange experience watching it. I mean, because he came into the screening and sat directly in front of me. And obviously I, you know, Dev Patel, you know, rooting for him at all times. And so I ended up kind of doing a very strange performance throughout, where I was acting as if I hadn't realized this. And I was just enthusiastic audience member that was kind of like laughing a little bit too loud. And I like think I did a few audible gasps and then turned to the person next to me at the end and was just like, well, that was excellent, wasn't it? I
wanted Dev to feel happy.
I think we all want Dev to feel happy. And I think he can genuinely feel happy. I think genuinely, you know, feel pride at what he's achieved. I mean, for a debut film, it is extraordinarily well sustained. And you know, it works. I mean, I was impressed even by the tangent that it goes into in the middle, where, you know, it's a conventional sequence for an action movie where the hero is beat down, he has to go somewhere to nurse his wounds, recover, and he goes to this temple that is staffed by a collective of outsiders, including, I think, various transgender and third gender performers. And there is sort of laughter there, and there is storytelling, and there is music, to the extent where he learns how to time his punches to the beat of a tabla drum, which is a very distinctive sort of twist on an action movie cliche. And it's almost like, after all the corruption and rot this film sets in front of, we should probably talk about what this film is saying about India, what it is and isn't saying. There is this sort of little oasis of calm, peace and sanity in the middle of it that is almost like a vision of what India still could be, you know, even after the elites have taken whatever they have out of the commons. You know, there is not only a vision of what India has become, the sort of rot and corruption, there is a vision of what it still could be. And I think, you know, I'm sure they're not going to push the political angle too heavily, because they will have an eye on international markets. And there has been some controversy over the way the flags in the early trailers, I think, were coded saffron, which is the colour that is associated with the BJP party. They have now been tweaked down, and so in the film they're sort of crimson red. Although I will say the robes, I think, in those rally scenes are still saffron. But I think it's genuinely one of those films that is just going to give the Indian censors nightmares and sleepless nights, you know, because you can't just tweak the flags or cut one or two lines of dialogue here or there. The injustice that it's working within, the injustice that it shows, and the sort of rage that it has at that injustice is so great that it's sort of so deeply baked in you couldn't extract it. So it was supposed to open, I believe, in India this weekend, the same as anywhere else in the world. I believe that release date is now drifted. If you go on the central cinema booking site, it's now saying release date to be confirmed. And obviously there's an election coming up in India. So that I suspect there's a lot of jitters going on in that part of the world about what to do with this film, because it's not flattering. I mean, the really bold thing about it, I think, is that unlike, say, the John Wick films, which is kind of like a fantasy land version of America, you know, this is clearly set in some kind of version of on-the-ground, street-level India, and it's trying to convey something about what India has become.
I was going to say that even for someone who doesn't understand the full political significance of what this story is saying, I feel like I clocked that this film was kind of talking to some extent about Modi and Hindu nationalism, I suppose, to some extent, which I can't fully comment on. But it was very striking to go from a friend of mine came over because they needed to use my TV to watch a film for review, and it was a film that it was a biopic about the founder of Hindu nationalism, and that was the last film I watched before I saw Monkey Man.
Bit of a contrast. Yeah.
So it was very interesting going from this sort of hagiography about it and to something, as you said, as angry and like as righteously angry as this, and displaying like these intersectional displays of solidarity, I thought was very invigorating. But to digress very quickly, because you mentioned John Wick, I do like that this film is very conscious of what it's immediately going to draw comparisons to, in that, like, you see a guy in a suit taking bloody revenge on people, people are going to immediately think John Wick. And so, of course, you have an arms dealer just being like, hey, you seen John Wick? I've got the gun from the movie. And I just really liked that, like, lampshading of it.
It's a preemptive strike, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think it's a testament to kind of Dev's storytelling potential that he is handling, like, these very... very outspoken kind of political slant to his narrative, balanced with the kind of this genre silliness in a way that I don't feel, they didn't feel like mutually exclusive. One thing fueled the other. I couldn't comment to like the extent of how good that political commentary is, especially with something like them having to tweak things for censors, which is a shame, but I suppose that's just how it goes. But I was very impressed with it all the same.
Well, you should get some scores on it, because actually we have an opportunity to talk about it more with the next film, because it's Dev's pick of them. But before we move on to that, Mike, do you want to go first with In Anticipation, Enjoyment, and In Retrospect?
Yeah, I think Anticipation 3, because it was sort of mixed with trepidation given how Patel had started out as an actor. So you wonder if his directorial career was going to go on similar lines. Enjoyment 4, I was absolutely with it all the way through, and I think it does get richer and weirder and more propulsive as it goes along. And then In Retrospect 4, because I think the ambition has absolutely been met by the execution of it. I think we should give Deb Patel a big rise in his pocket money.
Can't play. What about you?
I'm also at a 3 for Anticipation, just because when I saw the trailer I was interested, but I wasn't particularly... Like, I was like, oh, that's interesting, like, Dev Patel as an action star. It's not an expected image for him, I guess, because of what he has been typecast as in the past and the sort of more melodramatic roles that he's settled into. I didn't expect that it would translate into something like it did with this. So my enjoyment is 4, because it was very propulsive, it was very fun, it was very funny in a lot of places, and reminded me of all of my favorite kinds of movies. So hey, I'm not made of stone. That goes down to a 3 for In Retrospect, because I think when I came out of it, I had to piece a lot of it together, and not in the sort of fun allegorical way, more in a what the hell happened at this point. Not because it was weird or strange, because I loved the imagery of like him referring to the story of Hanuman, like with him opening up his chest. That kind of weird I live for. It was kind of just like this strange timing in some of the cuts to different scenes where I started getting a little bit lost in the middle because of this big jumble of ideas. But I just think with like a little more focus, he could knock another one like out of the park, and I hope he gets that chance.
Yeah, I think he will. I think I'm probably at kind of 3s across the board, but I do need to rewatch it because I was so focused on performing enthusiastic audience member to the back of Dev Patel's head.
You faked it, but
you
didn't make it.
I really don't feel like I can comment. But yeah, we should get a move on to Film Club, which is Dev's choice. It's A Bittersweet Life. When high-ranking gangster Young Soon Woo refuses to follow his boss Kanga's orders, things become ugly and turn into a gang war. So, Mike, I'm going to assume that this is not the first time you've come to this film.
Yeah, this took me way back in my reviewing career. When I started in the early noughties, there was a late lamented distributor called Metro Tartan, or Tartan, who specialised in putting out Asian action movies, you know, one or two a month, and I think largely with an eye on the DVD market, which was flourishing at that time. And we knew as weekly film critics that we were going to be guaranteed to see at least one pulpy, stylish, lurid thriller to keep us awake last thing on a Tuesday afternoon, which is kind of what you need when you're sitting in the darkness of the basements of screening rooms in Soho. And yeah, so I saw this when it first emerged, and it's a reminder of the sort of back and forth that was going on between East and West at that time in world cinema. The fact that, you know, Infernal Affairs gets turned into The Departed. It has a very familiar noir-y plot. It's the story of the guy who gets hired to look after the boss's girl, and then bad things happen. But on top of that, there's almost like a Michael Mann-ish character study about a neat freak who's rueing the fact that the world is not as neat as he hoped it would be. I mean, there's a reason he holes up in a hotel, which is a very controllable environment. And there's a shot very early on of our hero putting a sugar cube, one whole sugar cube, in a tiny espresso cup, which we see from above. And it's almost like that's the image that he wants to maintain, a very sort of neat, tidy, symmetrical view of the world. But then there are these sudden eruptions of messy energy and action, and by the halfway point, he's getting buried alive in mud. There are a whole bunch of films on this subject, because directors are notorious control freaks who want the world to be neater and tidier than it actually is. And you can feel this director's sympathy for a character who's having to deal with folks who aren't as well turned out as him. It's really fun, and it's really stylish. And you can clearly see the link between this and Monkey Man, because it's sleek and propulsive, but it's also nocturnal and spiritual. It has the sense of a world beyond the world we're existing in. Yeah, it was really fun to revisit this one.
Cam, do you think watching the Bittersweet Life kind of enhanced your experience of Monkey Man, or did it kind of become a bit of a same thing again?
Definitely not the same thing again. I think this is a lot more, I don't know if I want to say nihilistic, but a little bit pessimistic about with its worldview, as you were saying, like a man trying to square peg a round hole in terms of working in a criminal syndicate full of jabronis who can't keep
good
it together.
Good use of jabronis. That word really doesn't get used often.
I've been watching a lot of WWE lately.
Oh, okay.
But it was, yeah, the messiness of it was very compelling and did harken back to Monkey Man. In terms of Korean films, when Monkey Man was on, I was thinking primarily of The Man from Nowhere, because like that the knife fight from the end of that film is lodged in my brain, and they kind of just took a very similar tack where it's just like some very neat people getting very messy with sharp objects. Whereas this somehow, I think, got even uglier than that. Like you said, like contrasting like the neatness of his hotel suite to like a guy's head getting blown off and the camera like lingering on the kind of corner of skull that's missing. A lot of this film is very pointedly unpleasant, but in a kind of cartoonish way. There's a guy whose last words are simply just "ah fuck," and I think that sort of dismantling of the maybe any kind of perceived allure around organized crime is very decisive and just very amusing. And I think the film desperately needs that; otherwise, it's so grim. But on a more base level, who among us has not decided to ruin their entire lives for a beautiful woman?
I've left so many victims in my wake.
Somewhere there's a Bittersweet Life caused by Layla Latif.
I didn't realize this was one of those confessional podcasts where we have to come on and share, you know, the dirty laundry that's hidden away deep in our hearts.
I'm being completely facetious, but I did quite like seeing some of those sort of hallmarks of kind of in mid-2000s Korean cinema turns up, like the soundtrack that sounds like a waltz. A guy kind of a very violent man getting existential, that's that sort of thing. But there's a very, like I said, there's a very dark comedy to it that I think makes the bitterness, unintentional, a bit easier to swallow. But I guess that's kind of making an accidental play on the title is kind of in the spirit of the film, because I'm pretty sure the final fight takes place with a bar that says La Dolce Vita over the top. And I was like, right, okay, this is what we're dealing with here. It was my first time seeing it. I don't think I've actually seen a Kim Ji-woon film. I know he did some horror films like, what was it? I Saw the Devil and Tale of Two Sisters
was, his sort of big breakout, certainly over here, again, distributed by Tartan. So this was kind of, I think, his follow-up to that. And then weirdly, he sort of, having sort of expressed such sympathy for a neat freak, his films then get bigger and wilder and messier. So he goes on to do The Good, the Bad, the Weird, which is this deranged action movie that goes on to become a runaway hit. And then he goes to America and makes The Last Stand, which is a film that I rather enjoyed at the time. I haven't seen it since. But it's kind of like a cartoonish Western it was Arnold Schwarzenegger's big comeback vehicle. It was Arnie and Johnny Knoxville. And it's exactly what you expect from a Western set on Main Street starring Arnie and Johnny Knoxville. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and more cartoonish and louder. And it's a great deal of fun. It's got that sort of spirit about it that I sometimes miss in contemporary multiplex movies, which are all very self-serious. This was sort of gleefully cartoonish. And I think that was a flop. So Kim Ji-woon goes back to Korea and makes The Age of Shadows, which is a much more sort of more elegant Park Chan-wookish spy movie. So he starts tidying up after himself, but he, for a while there, he got a bit messy and wilder in the middle. But yeah, I mean, this is the thing with this film, is that yes, it will deliver if you're looking for Friday, Saturday night action, but it also has really deft and elegant things, like the whole business with mobile phones, and how this is a film that sort of got in early on the theory that mobile phones were going to completely mess up the 21st century. It was going to mess up the lining of your suit. It was going to mess up your ability to have a conversation with another person, your ability to move through space, you know, in peace and quiet. There was always going to be something bleeping or chirping. So that, you know, that's another one of its little messinesses. And I think it's both maximalist and minimalist at the same time, if you like, in the same way that it's both bitter and sweet. It manages to find a sort of happy medium, I think, on all fronts.
Happy medium in scare quotes there. Heavy on the bitter, I think.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's like chocolate. You know, how do you like your chocolate, Cam?
I was going to say, I'm kind of a milk chocolate person. I sneeze whenever I have dark chocolate. So maybe that's why this isn't a film for me.
This is becoming one of those confessional podcasts.
It's like, what is it, like, wrong to not sneezing be able to take 70%?
Milk chocolate, you child.
I think I have a mild allergy to it. I don't know.
To be fair, I'm with Cam reaction. All the way. Milk all the way. Oh, such a lightweight. God.
Sacrilege. 70% dark or nothing.
I still have it, just not as often.
Fair. But yeah, we should, I don't know, stop digressing wildly. So, Mr. Campbell A. Campbell, God, I really like saying your name. What is your non-movie recommendation this week?
My non-movie recommendation. I'm just trying to think of what I've been reading. Well, it's kind of movie related. I highly recommend reading the book Erasure by Percival Everett, on which the film American Fiction is based, because the book is funnier than the film, and it has the entirety of the fake book from American Fiction just in the middle of it. It's so good.
Yeah, the fake book in the middle of it is one of the funniest things I think I've ever read. And I never read Push. Was it Pusher by Sapphire?
Yes, yeah.
And I never watched the film adaptation of it, but somehow I knew exactly what it was satirizing.
I'm pretty sure, like, right before you read my pathology, there is just like there's a section where Monk is just like, I started thinking about Native Son. it's brilliant. I've also been reading the funny books, comic books, and there's a very good one called 20th Century Men by Denys Kamp, which basically reimagines the superhero story as a story of nationalism worldwide.
My goodness, that seems very like something a lot of people have done.
This does it differently. It's like kind of like the Cold War is reimagined, like, via kind of these totemic figures. Trust me, it's great.
Mike, what about you? What is your non-movie recommendation?
I've been becoming obsessed with a TV show that barely anybody saw at the time and has sort of disappeared from the popular imagination. I've been reading David Milch's memoir, Life's Work. David Milch, the writer, the guy who wrote large swathes of NYPD Blue and created Deadwood, the great revisionist western for HBO. And this is kind of his last will and testament. He's suffering with Alzheimer's as we speak, so he's getting everything out on the record. And one of the shows that he mentioned, I mean, if you read the book, you'll find out lots about shows you already know plenty about. But one of the shows he mentions in passing is a show called Big Apple, which is a sort of pre-9/11 police procedural that he knocked out between seasons of NYPD Blue that feels very much like a subplot from NYPD Blue that has been expanded to full series status. And the situation is the NYPD, represented by Ed O'Neill from Married with Children, and the FBI, represented by David Strathairn, who appears physically haunted by the ghost of J. Edgar Hoover, start investigating one another while working on a case, this one case. It's kind of fascinating as a sort of precursor to The Wire, which came out the following year. It feels like a sort of dry run for The Wire because it's about jurisdictional politics and you know, the fine lines both police and external agencies have to navigate. It's sort of fascinating in terms of where it fits in the canon of what we now know as copaganda. And it's very interesting to see just a network show, you know, from the days before streaming. You know, streaming shows now have $100 million too much and 5 episodes too many. This, they shot 8 episodes, only 6 episodes ever went out. It was put up against ER, you know, which was the big ratings hit of the time. So it sort of died a death. But it is genuinely fascinating as a little bit of history, as sort of a road not taken. You get to see a scene where Michael Madsen is being represented by Henry Winkler, which is not something you would see every day. Henry Winkler plays Michael Madsen's lawyer. You get to see a young Chris Messina in a leather jacket playing a crackhead. I mean, it's called Big Apple. It's all up on YouTube, all 8 episodes. I've just become quietly fascinated and obsessed with it over the last couple of weeks.
God, between this and learning about the Western with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Johnny Knoxville, you seem to be ingesting media that like is conceived in like a fever dream.
Yeah, that's how I like to live my life. Every day is a school day with me, you know, whether you like it or not.
You know what? The Johnny Knoxville mention has me... I'm sorry, one more thing. WrestleMania. That's my non-movie thing. That's my other non-movie thing, because it's this weekend. It's going to be awesome. Johnny Knoxville once had a wrestling match with a guy called Sami Zayn. It's very funny. The Rock is back. He's a heel. Ooh. Things have never looked better.
He's turned to the dark side, has he?
Oh, big time. He's like whooping children's heroes on live television. It's fantastic.
Wow. I mean, yes, that's quite the amount of homework that we've got to go.
Fun work.
So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, we have Kristen Dunst and Alex Garland on to talk Civil War, and we'll also review the Amy Winehouse biopic Back to Black. For Film Club, it's Dunst at her finest in Melancholia. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Mike McMahill and Campbell A. Campbell. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.